You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a lot coming up today. You know, there's actually a strong argument to be made for Mayor Bloomberg's ban on big sugary drink. We're going to get into that in the next hour. It's going to be a lot of fun. And in our third hour, J.A. Meyerson is going to drop by. Occupy Wall Street participant. Today is the first anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And, in fact, I want to get into what I think is, frankly, a deeper understanding. I see that as one of the main jobs of this show, is to look, you know, beneath the talking points of things. You know, to understand the plight of the American middle class today, you have to understand that an actual crime has taken place. The middle class isn't dying today because of a random financial crisis in 2007. You know, maybe George Bush had something to do with it, triggering a deep and long-lasting recession like 1920. No. I mean, all that happened. But the middle class is dying today because of a decades-long, three decades at least, arguably criminal effort to rig the American economy in favor of the corporate elite and the very wealthy and transfer massive amounts of money from the vast majority of Americans up to the top 1%. We're now in the final stages of this effort, what I call the cancer stage of capitalism, and more Americans are waking up to what's really happening. Progressive Senate candidate in Massachusetts, Elizabeth Warren, spoke directly to this issue in her DNC speech. Here she is.
People feel like the system is rigged against them. And here's the painful part. They're right. The system is rigged. Look around. Oil companies guzzle down billions in profits. Billionaires pay lower tax rates than their secretaries. And Wall Street CEOs, the same ones who wrecked our economy and destroyed millions of jobs, still strut around Congress, no shame, demanding favors, and acting like we should thank them. Does anyone here have a problem with that?
Yeah, I do. Warren, Elizabeth Warren is really one smart woman. And like other smart Americans, she's wised up to what's really happening in our nation, which is the outright theft of the wealth of the middle class and the passing of it along to the top 1%ers. In a recent article published for Alternet, David DeGraw, another smart American, highlights each incident of theft against the middle class by the corporate elite. There's the Reagan tax cuts and the destruction of labor unions beginning in the 1970s that has fueled an enormous pay gap between CEOs and workers, so that 32 years ago when Reagan came into power, CEOs made 25 times more than their average worker. Today, 500 times more than their average worker. Those same policies, 32 years of Reaganomics, have resulted in the top 1% seeing their share of national income triple over the last three decades, while the bottom 90% have seen their share drop by 20%. Years of lobbying and outright bribery have rigged the tax code against working Americans, forcing them to pay a higher tax rate than members of the corporate elite like Mitt Romney and Warren Buffett. And not only that, those higher tax rates paid by working people, they don't flow through the coffers of government to be reinvested to help the working class with things like better social services or better education or better infrastructure. Instead, that revenue is going straight to corporate treasuries in the form of bailouts to Wall Street, tax subsidies to the oil industry, and giveaways to the for-profit health insurance cartels. For instance, the Wall Street bailout financed by taxpayers like you and me led to banksters getting paid more than $150 billion in bonuses just in 2009. While that same year, we the taxpayers lost 25% of the value of our 401ks. That same year, the richest 400 Americans, 400 people, increased their wealth by $30 billion, giving them more wealth than the bottom 155 million Americans combined. That's about half of America. As DeGraw points out, had our taxpayer money been invested in job creation rather than passed out as Wall Street bailouts, 5 million Americans could have been put back to work earning $30,000 a year each. Our unemployment rate would be like 5% right now, 4%. But that didn't happen. Instead, more than $14 trillion was quietly passed out to Wall Street and corporate America. Trillions more went to our for-profit military-industrial complex so they could profit from our never-ending war on terror. And not a single penny was reinvested in better education, better health care, better infrastructure, or job creation for working Americans. And working Americans really needed all that wealth that's been taken from them. Because before Bush, Americans spent 7% of their income on food and energy. Today, it's 20%. Working Americans pay 8% of their income on health care, more than any other nation in the developed world, and yet we get the worst results. Meanwhile, the cost of housing for the middle class has gone up 34%. So when all of these necessities are added together, Americans have to use their credit cards to make ends meet and are forced to go deeper and deeper into debt since our wallets have been picked by the corporate elite. As Elizabeth Warren said, the game is rigged. And if it wasn't rigged, if wages for working people had continued to rise along with productivity, like happened during the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter presidencies, all of them, every single one of those, as productivity went up, wages went up. And then came Reagan, and productivity continued to go up, wages flattened out. If the rich still paid their fair share in taxes and the Reagan tax cuts had never happened, and if wealth distribution in America stayed on track with where it was in the Carter 70s, then today... Now, listen carefully to this. This is astounding. Then today, the middle class would be thriving. DeGraw argues, had the corporate elite not stolen so much money from us over the last 32 years, right now, the average middle class income would be about $100,000. We'd be able to afford free health care for every American. Every American family would be able to afford a four-bedroom house. We would be able to afford free college for all of our kids and 21st century roads, bridges, public transportation, and internet infrastructure. We could also afford a 5% income tax rate moving forward for 99% of all Americans. The potential for all of these things I just mentioned was stolen by the corporate elite with the help of Republicans Ronald Reagan, both George Bushes, and their cronies in Congress. And smart people are waking up to this reality and saying enough is enough, which explains why Rick Santorum, what he was talking about last week when he said this about support for the Republican Party.
We will never have the elite smart people on our side because they believe they should have the power to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
So our colleges and universities, they're not going to be on our side.
Right. They're never going to be on your side, Rick. The smart people will never be on your side. They will not vote for you because smart people will not endorse the sort of middle-class destroying policies that useful idiots like you are pushing. The smart people, the Americans who know about this theft, are standing up and speaking out against it. The smart people know how to reverse the damage that's been done. They know that we have to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. We have to strengthen protections for labor unions. Taxpayer money has to be reinvested in the community and not given to transnational corporations to build factories in Vietnam and pay their CEOs billions. We got to figure it out. Ricky, we know what's going on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's just incredible. What has been stolen from us? Free health care, free college, cheap renewable energy. At the very least, all of that has been stolen from us with 30 years of Reaganomics.
Hey, Governor Walker, you better go back to school, study our democracy, and brush up on the golden rule. Hey, Governor Walker.
Yeah, hey, Governor Walker, thanks but no thanks, right? Isn't that amazing? The Ricky Santorum came out and said smart people are never going to be on our side. Could it be, you know, one of the taglines we use for this show is the place where smart people get their news. It's amazing. Chicago Teachers Union is now entering its second week. We'll keep you up to date on that. Mayor Emanuel is talking about using the law to try to force them back into work or back into their classrooms, classrooms that don't have air conditioning, don't have school supplies, don't have counselors, don't have nurses, and either a third of them don't have libraries or two-thirds of them don't have libraries. I forget which it is. Only a third have libraries or a third don't have libraries. But it should be zero, right? It should be all of them have libraries. Incredible. Colorado, legalizing pot. It's polling at 51% right now. You know what that means? That means that the tobacco companies, the alcohol companies, the private prison complex, all the folks who conspired to knock down pot legalization in California when it was polling above 50%, and then they dumped millions of dollars into TV ads going, oh, you really don't want to do that, do you? You know, gateway drugs and all that kind of stuff. They're going to start pouring their money into Colorado. Because, hey, there is money to be made on Nixon's drug war. There are, you know, careers and lives in the balance. Private prison industry's got to have bodies. They got to have people to stick in cells. The drug testing industry, I mean, what are they going to do with all these drug testing kits that cost them 13 cents worth of chemicals and they sell for $35 a piece to school systems and trucking companies and police departments and whatnot? By the way, what is it that France knows that we don't know? Did you know that France has banned all of Monsanto's GMO products and they have banned fracking? France just said no to Halliburton. Now, we're going to take Nancy Reagan's advice, just say no. Meanwhile, Kofi Annan, as in United Nations, right? The UN, Kofi Annan, chair of a new commission on democracies around the world, says one of the democracies on Earth that is most at risk. Now, consider this seriously for a moment. The United Nations looked at democracies around the world. This was an independent, or I don't know how independent you could be if you're funded by the UN, but it was a UN panel. And they looked at democracies around the world, and they concluded that because of Citizens United, our democracy is one of the most at-risk ones in the world. Make any sense? It's absolutely incredible. John Nichols on the line with us, the Washington Bureau Chief for The Nation magazine and the author of Uprising, thenation.com, of course, the website. Hey, John, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
So Scott Walker in your home state of Wisconsin, his anti-labor initiative has been ruled unconstitutional, and he's been reduced to name calling. Do I get that right?
I think you nailed it. I'll see you later.
Well, I have a feeling there's going to be another act to this play.
There sure is, and we should sum it up in the best ways. I don't know if we'll get a better gift on the 225th anniversary of the Constitution than a judge's ruling that asserts that no matter how much Scott Walker and Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan may scream about it, working people have the same equal protection rights as everybody else in America. And that's what a judge said.
That's shocking.
I know.
I thought rich people had the rights and everybody else was just supposed to do what they were told.
They would share them with us now and again.
Yeah.
Well, no. And you know, this is a funny thing. You and I may have recognized this a year and a half ago. A lot of the people in the streets protesting in Madison did. They held signs that said workers' rights are human rights and that what Walker was doing was illegal. Mm. Most of the pundit class rejected that notion because they don't actually read the Constitution very closely and they don't take it very seriously. Certainly most of the conservatives rejected that notion. But a couple of unions that got really hit hard by Walker's labor law changes in Wisconsin sued. As Madison Teachers Incorporated and the sanitation workers in Milwaukee. Mm. And they said, hold it. Walker has established a different set of rules for teachers and garbage truck drivers than for cops and firefighters. You can't do that. You can't have unequal protection. And they found a judge.
Hang on just a second. Because his union stripping laws singled out public employees and didn't include private employees? Is that what you're talking about?
No, different rules for different public employees.
Oh.
Even.
Wow.
Yeah, the law, he wrote this law. He didn't want to have the cops opposing him.
Oh, that's right. He didn't want the police to be PO'd at him.
Right. And so because he did that, and because he had different rules for bus drivers than for garbage truck drivers, you know, it was an absurd construct done purely for political purposes. And we said this all along. But this judge, who before he became a judge, worked for Republican attorneys general. He's not certainly not some big lefty radical.
Right.
Said, look, this is an absolute violation of the equal protection clauses of the U.S. Constitution and the state constitution. And he ruled Governor Walker's law null and void.
Wow.
For municipal workers and for public school teachers. This is a very big deal.
So now this was a county judge. Do I have this right?
It's a circuit court judge. Wisconsin has three levels of judges: circuit court, appeals court, and state supreme court.
Right. So now it's going to go to the appeals court, or is it going to go to a federal court since he invoked the U.S. Constitution?
That's the beauty of it, Tom. You're smart enough to know that. By bringing in both constitutions, he created several routes by which this. There will be appeals. Of course, the governor's going to appeal.
Right.
But he created several routes to do it. The governor, of course, dismissed him as a liberal activist judge. But if you read the ruling,
he's a former Republican.
I don't know if he's a Republican or a Democrat, but he worked for Republicans. The bottom line is he wrote a sound decision.
It'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court looks like by the time it gets there. Thanks, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Amazing. Yeah, Wisconsin collective bargaining law. Scott Walker's favorite piece of legislation. He got to screw the working person. Knocked down by a state judge.
Come on, all good workers. This year is our time. Now there's folks in Washington who care what's on our mind. Come on, come on, voters. Let's all vote next time. Show which side are
35 minutes past the hour. Yeah, you want to know what's at stake in this election? The Supreme Court. And what does that mean? Center for American Progress has a really fascinating little report here. It actually came from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. If Obama is president for the next 4 years and replaces at least one of the right-wing justices on the Supreme Court, then we could see the buying of democracy, Citizens United, overturned. We could see a Supreme Court decision called Circuit City versus Adams forced arbitration. In other words, you lose your right to sue. We could see that overturned, so you'd regain your right to sue a company if you've been screwed by them. We could see voter suppression be overturned. These were all one vote decision cases. This was called Crawford versus Marion County. Voter suppression was ruled legal by the five right wingers on the court. If Obama gets the next term, if he gets the next 4 years, that'll probably be overturned. Voter suppression. Discrimination. The five conservative judges said that organizations can freely discriminate as long as they're private organizations. Private clubs can freely discriminate. This was Boy Scouts versus Dale. In this case, it was discrimination based on sexual orientation. And in Gross versus FBL Services, older workers were told, sorry, age discrimination, you can't sue over that anymore. That could be overturned. Okay, that's what happens if Obama becomes president over the next 4 years. If Romney becomes president over the next 4 years and we add one more conservative to the court, here are cases that went 5-4 against the conservatives that would flip 5-4 in favor of the conservatives and would be reconsidered. Healthcare, Obamacare. Obamacare was 5-4 in favor. John Roberts said, hey, it's just a tax and, you know, Congress has the right to tax. Judges being for sale. The four conservatives said, hey, it's fine for judges to be for sale, but they couldn't get a fifth vote. Presumably it was Kennedy. gay rights, Lawrence versus Texas. In a Romney administration, that could be overturned. So it's legal to have laws against being gay. In a Romney administration, corporate greed. This was called Cuomo versus Clearinghouse. And this was an attempt by the banking industry to say, sorry, we don't have to pay attention to state laws. The banking industry won. Excuse me, the banking industry lost. In a Romney administration, the banking industry would win because he'd add one more right-wing crack-a-doodle, whack-a-doodle, whatever, to the court. And Roe v. Wade. They got 4 votes right now to overturn Roe v. Wade. They need one more. There's a lot at stake here. It's pretty amazing when you consider it. You know, it's a lot at stake. Jason in Homestead, Florida. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was just calling because of the coverage I've seen from the left media on the teachers' strike and everything in Chicago.
Right.
And both from the TV and the radio and so forth. And I just wanted to bring out another perspective because I'm a former teacher. My mom's a chairperson at a local school down here, you know, and I'm trying to now use my education degree and internships and everything at another state. And all I heard is people, you know, saying that these teachers, you know, oh, these are the results of the teachers and they should own up to it and all that. And I see my mom, she has a computer that does not have the proper software for her to use. And it took 2 weeks to have the proper classroom, and she's a chairperson at a school
mm-hmm.
at a at risk on population,
mm-hmm.
you know. And here I am trying to use my something that people don't think about with teachers. If I try to go to another state, there's no national organization that gets all the certified stuff, all the courses you
for
take
accreditation,
and everything.
Right?
I think yeah, everything, right. You know, sent just directly to you have to do it all yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It has to be sent to you. You have to, and it takes forever, and it's a big hassle. And all these things aren't considered at all. I mean, my mom deals with people that insert themselves before her in getting the education to the students.
Yeah.
You know, they say, oh, you have to do the FCAT, you have to do this, you have to do this this way and everything. And then they want to come back and blame the teachers of this country.
Right.
And that's very frustrating to me, as you can tell.
Well, the whole blame the teachers thing is a part of the whole blame anybody who doesn't work at Walmart wages thing. I mean, we've had 32 years now of trickle-down economics, the race to the bottom for wages. We've seen wages, you know, drop substantially. The top 1% has gotten, you know, they've more than doubled their wealth, arguably more than tripled their wealth since Reagan came into office. It's just an explosion of wealth at the top 1%. And a collapse of wealth for the bottom five-sixths?
And that's all great, and I understand that.
Four-fifths.
What gets to me is that the people that I'm hearing out there, and these are well-known people, one of them's, you know, representing Obama, trying to get him reelected, going out there protesting, and they don't see that these middle people involved. They just see that, you know, and I'm sorry, that is frustrating as heck, because if you don't have good education from teachers, then you're going to have to forget everything else.
Yeah, no, I'm with you, and it's
and
not.
I see my mom, Buster. I'm sorry, I'm not going to use that word, but I see my mom just what her life is trying to do the right thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Down here in the southeast of the United States.
And it's not just the teachers; it's the environment in which they are teaching. I mean, you know, from the poverty of the kids to the homelessness of the kids to the fact that, you know, in Chicago you've got, you know, a third of the schools at least don't even have a library. Half the schools don't have a music teacher. Or I don't know if you saw the piece in the New York Times where they found that kids who learn a musical instrument when they're young, throughout their entire lives, have better verbal skills. They understand things better. Their brain, you know, when it comes to auditory processing, language processing, logical processing, works better. I mean, you know, Jason, you nailed it. Thanks so much for the call. So very well said. David in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, I'm in absolute agreement with that United Nations assessment about democracies that are at risk.
Yeah.
With America, because I look at America and its wide variety of cultures and different people. I mean, we've got some conservative people, then we got some moderates, and then we've got some people that are very liberated in their lifestyles. There's a wide variety of interests and entertainment. And then I immediately started to think about Germany in the 1920s as it was recovering from World War I. So you have the Weimar Republic, and you had a wide variety of art movements, burlesque, and even some fantastic films. I mean, Metropolis is kind of a byproduct of all the different entertainment that was going on. Yeah. And people thought, yeah, things can't get any better. But then the brown shirts came in, who were a minority at the time in the late 20s, early 30s, and they had the big fat lie that, you know, FDR had to kind of reference a decade later. And then all of a sudden, this democracy just crashed down faster than a meteor. And that very, and if people think that that can never happen in America, people are sorely mistaken.
Well, keep in mind the thing that so weakened the Weimar Republic that it created a space for Hitler to step into, and that was the Treaty of Versailles. After World War I, the Axis or the Allied powers got together and said, "How are we going to punish Germany for the, you know, for World War I, for the damage that they caused?" And what they concluded was, "Let's have Germany pay back everybody for all of their costs." And so they hit Germany with this huge charge that had to be repaid in Deutschmarks, in German currency. And so the Germans, not being idiots, said, okay, we could spend the next 100 years paying this off to all these other countries, and it literally would have taken that long. Or we could simply deflate our currency. We could inflate our currency, devalue our currency, reduce the value of our currency, so that what is right now, you know, right now one Deutschmark might buy 5 loaves of bread. Well, let's flip that upside down and make it, you know, 5 Deutschmarks will buy 1 loaf of bread. And that way we can pay off these countries in 1/10 the time. You know, we can pay them off in 10 years. And so they started deflating their currency. It got out of control, and you ended up with a wheelbarrow full of Deutschmarks having to, you know, to go to the store to buy a loaf of bread. You ended up with a situation where people were taking breaks from work every 2 hours to go to the store to buy things because prices every 2 hours were going up 5, 10, 15%. And that wild inflation where it took over 1 billion Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread ultimately, A, allowed Germany to completely pay off their World War I debt, but B, decimated the German people. I mean, it just wiped them out. And so Hitler stepped into that vacuum and said, hey, you know, I got the solution to this. Just, you know, put me in charge. And so, you know, it speaks to the danger of, and this is why I think, you know, so many conservatives are all hysterical about what the Fed is doing, you know, with QE3. I don't think the Fed is even close to what the Germans did during the Weimar Republic. Not even close. I mean, not even 0.1% close. But it's why people get hysterical about inflation, is because we saw that movie once before. So, you know, there are mitigating factors. You know, if Hitler had just run around yelling about the Jews and the Catholics and the gays and whatnot, and you know, conspiracy, nobody would have paid attention to him. I mean, you know, the first couple of years, by and large, nobody paid attention to him. But when the economy really went in the tank, and that's why 3 years of the Republicans trying to destroy the economy in the United States so that they can kick Barack Obama out of office, that's why that's so dangerous. That's why the right-wing crazies, thank you, Treat David, for bringing this up, that's why the right-wing crazies are so aggressive at taking advantage of this and trying to blame it on Obama and trying to blame it on minorities, blame it on the immigrants.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is, as they say, a strategy that has worked before. Let's hope it doesn't work again. 46 minutes past the hour. Media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. 9.5 minutes before the hour, and Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Appreciate you. I just want to respond to all this warning of how things are going to get worse to the right.
If Romney gets elected, you mean?
Pardon me?
If Romney wins the presidency?
Oh, yeah. Does it occur to people that we've just, you know, a lot of people are just not going to tolerate it.
Well,
and
you know, we're already in the
be
streets, Bob.
So much on the air.
We are already on the streets. It's called the Occupy
movement.
We're
not going to tolerate it.
So what are you going to do?
Well, What do you want me to do? What do you want me to tell you that I'm going to do? I'm going to tell you that the majority of people are not going to sit idly by, whether this man cheats his way into the office, whether our election process is completely corrupted, whether the corporations, you know why nobody's, you say nobody's figured this out yet at Monsanto or in our country? That's not it. It's not that we haven't figured out what Monsanto's doing, it's that we don't have the courage to stop them, because it's all based, the power paradigm conversation that we're having here that's forced on to people in this country is that everything is about money, and yep. that's that. Well, that's not true, and these people are going to, they're going to totally annihilate our country, and then it will be too late to fight back.
Well, I'm not sure.
You can fight all you want with money and words, and I'm all for that. I'm an artist and I'm a writer. But that's not going to stop these people from devastating. The dominant culture is not going to stop until it completely ruins our society. And if we don't have the guts to stop it, it's not going to be stopped.
Yeah. Bob, we have been here before. We were here the last time we had Bob, can you hear me?
Over again until we change the conversation into something.
For some reason, people can't hear me when I'm talking.
Into that people can do.
Bob clearly can't hear me.
Their own homes and not have to be
Bob, I got it. I got your point. Thank you very much for the call. We have been here before. We were here in the 1930s. We had an Occupy movement in the 1930s. It was called the Bonus Army. They occupied the White House from literally the lawn of the White House all the way down to the Potomac River. Thousands, tens of thousands of people. Herbert Hoover ordered the military to come in and clear them out, burn them out, kill some of them. I mean, we've been here before. We've got the Occupy. I would say to you, Bob, we are already in the streets. The Occupy movement is out there. I agree with you. If the Romney administration, if Romney gets an administration, if Romney wins, if the Romney campaign wins, and particularly if it's the way George W. Bush won, by having the Supreme Court put him into place, or if it's the way George W. Bush won in 2004, by having some very, very, very dicey ballots that were being counted in another state on a computer system owned by Karl Rove, call the election. If it's that kind of thing, then I suspect that there's going to be a lot of people in the streets. But we were in the streets in the 60s against the Vietnam War, too. What I don't want to go back to is when we were in the streets in the 1860s and we had a civil war over this kind of thing. And frankly, I don't think that that's what's going to happen. I genuinely don't. Because the South, viewed themselves as completely separate, and they developed their own militia. And, some really nasty stuff happened. But people are going to get out there. And they are, as I said, they already are. Ken in Joliet, Illinois. Hey, Ken, what's up? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
I was going to mention about the labor. Illinois had I used to do labor law. And Illinois has a separate system. Like you see the Chicago teacher strike, and you never see a police strike because they have interest arbitration. All the public employees in Wisconsin had interest arbitrations. That's why you.
What
never
is
saw.
Interest arbitration?
Okay, it's if the sides can't reach an impasse, it goes to an arbitrator. The arbitrator decides who wins. And that's the contract.
Right. So that's the same as any kind of arbitration.
Yeah.
Is interest arbitration any different than just normal arbitration?
No. Oh, okay. But it decides what's going to be in the contract.
Right.
Both sides put in their proposals and the arbitrator decides. And,
right. No, I understand. And like increasingly when you buy products, it says you can't sue the company. You're surrendering that right under the Constitution. You're going to have to go to arbitration, and that was what was decided in let's see, which case was it? It was one of these cases that I was just talking. Oh, forced arbitration. It was Circuit City versus Adams. That was decided by a 5-4 right wing decision that corporations can force arbitration on you simply by clicking yes, I agree if it's software, or simply by getting a piece of paper when you buy a product.
Oh yeah. Well, that's a private thing. In the public sector, what the unions gave up was the right to strike.
the police
union. The employer gave up was the right to basically, bring in ads and close the unions down.
Right.
Now, in Illinois, I'm interested to see if this thing gets to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, because Illinois has a dual system.
Has what?
It has a dual system.
Okay.
Teachers don't have interest arbitration. Police do.
Right.
So if the Seventh Circuit rules that...
So are you suggesting that's a violation of the 14th Amendment?
It could be, you know. It's never been raised in Illinois, to my knowledge, you know.
Yeah.
I think they would go back to the
precedent in Circuit City versus Adams, though, where the Supreme Court said that, you know, forcing arbitration is just fine in a 5-4 decision just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but it's a contract. You're making a contract. You know, it's an unequal bargaining power in the contract, but it's a contract.
Right. So you're saying both parties agreed to it, therefore.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. All right. It'll be interesting to watch. Ken, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. Interesting thought. We'll be back. Is there anything to be said for Mayor Bloomberg saying no to sugary drinks in New York?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Boy, this is amazing. The Tea Party is now less popular in the United States than Muslims or atheists. Amazing. I just find that incredible. Kerry Lucas on the line with us, the Managing Director of the Independent Women's Forum. IWF.org is the website. Mayor Bloomberg has, in an 8-0 vote, the New York City Board of Health approved Mayor Michael Bloomberg's far-reaching ban on the sale of large sugar-infused, or I would say high-fructose corn syrup-infused beverages in restaurants, fast food joints, delis, movie theaters, athletic venues, and even food carts across the city. And, Carrie, I know you have an opinion on this.
Well, you know, Tom, I'm actually really interested to hear your opinion on this, because I was listening to your news prelude, and you talked, all with excitement, and I understand that, about the Colorado measure to make marijuana legal.
Yes.
So it seems to me very strange that we would have, hooray, we can all say, get government out of this business, but here we have this assault on, we don't want government telling people whether or not they can have marijuana, but heaven forbid they have a big gulp. I don't understand what the consistency is here. How you decide which things government should and should not be in charge of banning.
Well, first of all, the Colorado proposal, the Colorado initiative, which has 51% support among the people of that state, so therefore you will see the private prison industry and the tobacco companies coming with millions of dollars to stop it. That's actually get government into the business of marijuana, because they want to regulate it like tobacco and alcohol. And those are, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is a substantial bureaucracy. And they put a lot of work into making sure that underage people don't buy alcohol, and that the sale of cigarettes is well regulated, and they can only be displayed and advertised in certain ways, and all those kind of things. So that's kind of a big government response, Carrie. I'm more in favor of the Portugal response, which is simply decriminalize everything and just, leave it all alone, turn it all into a
public health. What about big gulps? Should we decriminalize big gulps?
Let's talk about big gulps here. first of all, I'm guessing if you walk down the street with a big gulp, you're not going to get arrested. It's the sale of them that is being criminalized. But here are the stats that New York City has laid out. And the mayor has this huge study, and I'm guessing you've probably seen it. It's over at the New York City website. Sugary drink consumption is associated with weight gain in both adults and children. They got four different studies on that. Liquid food is processed differently by the body than solids. It produces a larger weight gain than solid food similarly does, because it goes through faster. More than half of New York City adults, 58%, are obese. 40% of New York City's public school systems are obese. 5,000 deaths per year as a, this is K through eight, 5,000 deaths per year as a result of obesity. And so shorter lifespan. The cost associated just for New York City, this is just New York City, $4.7 billion annual obesity direct related medical costs. $1,500 is the annual cost of obesity to every single New York City household. $1,429 is the increase in medical spending for obese versus normal weight adults, about that $1,500. And then they look at this. People given beverages 50% larger consume 20 to 33% more with no change in the amount of food that they're eating. People given larger portion sizes of food eat 20% more without completely reducing their intake at subsequent meals.
First I'm going to agree with you. Definitely there's a problem in New York. I'm sure there's a lot of people eating a lot of unhealthy things and drinking a lot of unhealthy things. I can come back at you. There's studies that show just how completely inept other government efforts to try to make people thinner, from soda taxes to other regulations to the trans fat bans, that there's very little that shows that government...
Well, the trans fat ban is to prevent cancer and heart disease.
Okay, well, fine. But it doesn't change people's behavior. It doesn't change how people eat. People find other ways to get what they want. In the same way, a lot of the cigarette taxes and things end up being,
cigarette taxes demonstrably reduce consumption of cigarettes.
Causing more problems than they solve.
The cigarette taxes actually solve a problem.
Okay, so you think that cigarette taxes, as a soda tax.
The tobacco companies would be the first to tell you, Carrie, that when cigarette taxes go up, cigarette consumption goes down. That's why they fight them.
No, but, okay. I mean, we've seen in state after state that the reason why places tax cigarettes is because it's an inelastic demand. People are addicted to cigarettes, and so they're going to buy them one way or another. It creates black markets.
Around state boundaries, so I don't disagree with you.
I can tell you don't actually want to talk about the soda ban because it's so patently absurd and frankly insulting. I mean, where is it? You guys, you're supposed to be a good liberal, Tom. How is it that you think that this is, we're supposed to be my body, my choice, and here you are saying that it should be illegal for an adult in New York to have a big gulp? I mean, what is the limits of the state's power? If they think that they can come in and tell you how much soda you can drink.
Well, Carrie, I will be the first to tell you that I am ambivalent about this. I could argue either side of this thing and I think argue it effectively. I really do see both sides of this argument. But here's the thing, just for the sake of this argument, I'll take Mayor Bloomberg's side of this, because I think that there is something to be said. Sugary drinks comprise 7% of the average American's diet. That's 140 calories per day, 7%. And that's an average of 15 pounds per year gained just as a consequence of sugary drinks.
We don't eat well. So what do you want? How far are we willing to go? Do we think that the government should require everyone to eat a certain amount of leafy vegetables, or if you don't want to require them to buy, which now, liberals are fine with forcing people to buy anything. So make us all buy a certain allotment of broccoli, force us to exercise. I mean, where is it that we decide? What is government's role in deciding and making decisions?
I think making sure that everybody has health insurance is a completely different thing than forcing people to eat broccoli, first of all. And secondly, the argument that they're making here is that they're spending a fortune because of these big gulp
drinks. But Tom, once you get into that, government can justify anything. You could say the same thing about, sex is supposed to be off limits, but they spend a whole lot of money dealing with STDs and with unwanted pregnancies and things like this.
But they're already cracking down on sex for sale.
Your argument is an invitation.
They're already doing that, Carrie. They're already doing that. Prostitution is already illegal in New York City.
Okay, well that's a totally different thing, and I understand the case for legalization on that end. I just can't imagine why it is that supposed liberals are out there acting for the government to be the biggest scolds and nannies for Americans, really treating us as like infants. It seems as though it's just so strange to me that you would have, you're supposed to believe in personal freedom, that personal freedom doesn't extend to deciding whether I can have a salty potato chip or have a soda. And, you know, one of the things, you know, there's a lot of evidence that shows that a lot of people who are drinking, overweight people, most obese people, when they're drinking soda, they're already drinking diet soda. And it's this idea that...
Well, the diet sodas, though, trick the brain. They cause you to actually eat more food. Diet sodas do functionally the exact same thing. They cause you to eat more food because they make your pancreas think that there's sugar coming. But the point is that more than 40% the added sugars in our diet comes from these drinks. And so they've identified this one area where they may be able to save the lives of thousands of people and reduce the cost of the city by millions of dollars.
You actually think that this by outlawing...
Well, I really don't know. And as I said, I could argue either side of this, but the Bloomberg administration and his...
Why don't we err on the side of freedom, Tom? If we both see that there's two sides to this, why don't we err on the side of actually giving Americans liberty?
Because we've already done that, and we now have a 40% obesity rate in New York City, which we didn't have before the big gulps came along.
So bring in Fuhrer Bloomberg to come in and tell us exactly what we should eat because Americans haven't used...
Well, do you have a better solution?
Pretty frightening. Yes, just let people make their own decisions.
Let people get fat and die.
How fat anyone is.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, I suppose that's the corporate free market path. Carrie Lucas, IWF.org. You had the last word, Carrie, I guess. Thank you very much.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, well, you know, what do you think about this? I mean, if it's really true that these soft drinks are the one thing that really makes a difference? Okay, I think, you know, one of the most interesting charts that the Bloomberg administration has put out is the result of a study that was done this year, 2012. And what would happen if consumers simply switched to 16-ounce beverages, instead of 32-ounce? In other words, no more big gulps, just 16 ounces. And I don't know how anybody could drink more than 16 ounces anyway, unless you're buying, like, your whole day supply and carrying it around with you. And by that time, it's mostly ice water, isn't it? And it's like, yuck. But in any case, some people just, you know, chow these things down, that the change in per 1,000 calories that would happen to transactions that include beverages subject to the policy on sugared beverages, that there would be about a 20% difference in the number of calories that people would be consuming. This is interesting. Physical activity is not enough. You have to walk the 3 miles from Union Square to Brooklyn to burn off the calories in one 20-ounce soda. You have to walk 3 miles to burn off the calories in one 20-ounce soft drink. So, you know, what do you think? Now, we can also talk about, you know, other topics of the day as well if you want to get into those. And I see we've got a bunch of callers left over from the previous hour as well. And we had a doctor on there just a second ago who wanted to talk about sugar drinks, but he dropped off the line. Oh, well. But the whole sugar drink thing, I just find it fascinating. Consumer freedom is preserved. The proposal is not a ban on sugary drinks. You're free to consume more than 16 ounces of sugary drinks. You already have limited choices of portion sizes determined by restaurants or beverage company. You walk into a restaurant and they say, you order a Coke, and they say, okay, here you go. And you say, no, wait a minute, I want one three times that big. And they say, fine, we'll bring you three of them. I mean, do you yell about the fact that they won't bring you 60 ounces of Coke to your table? And what the Bloomberg administration is suggesting is that the options for smaller, healthier drinks are actually enhanced by this proposal. But here's the important thing. People given beverages 50% larger, they consume more, 20 to 33% more than people who are not. They just don't even realize it. It's like people just don't even realize it. So let's make it easy. Now, I get it. You could say, oh, that's, you know, nanny state on steroids. And maybe it is. Maybe, though, there's a time for that. Stuart, in Seacliff, New York, listening on WWRL. You're in New York City. This is going to affect you, Stuart. What's up?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I'm Stuart. I met you at a Demos event a couple years ago. I gave you a IOTC Local 1 T-shirt.
Oh, yeah. Great. Nice to have you call, Stuart. What's up?
Great to talk to you again. I think this I agree with the ban, but I think it's all like trying to put the genie back in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And I go back to this documentary I saw, which you can see on YouTube, called "Consuming Kids."
Right.
And it talks about how Reagan deregulated the Federal Trade Commission, and the United States became the first country to allow Madison Avenue loose on our kids and directly advertise towards children. And soft drinks, junk food, and they had these seminars called the NAG Factor, and they would study kids with their eye movement and what catches their eye, and they're completely submersed in advertising, you know, text
right.
messages and the internet and stuff.
Right.
And I think that's a big part of it.
I don't disagree. And in fact, you know, the basic message of all advertising is you are the most important person in the universe, and your needs trump everything. And this is going to meet your needs, right? That's the core message of most advertising. And what it does is it creates an infantile worldview. And I would submit to you that one of the reasons why it seems like adults in our society increasingly are behaving like infants, you know, I want mine, I want it now, I don't care about anybody else, that sort of thing. And we particularly see that in the conservative world. The reason why we're seeing more and more of that is the influence of advertising on children since the early 80s, when you're right. It used to be before the 80s it was illegal to advertise to children. It still is in many countries, and it's not in the United States.
I have one more point to that. I think the culmination of it was Joe Camel. And then it took parents, outraged parents, to finally kill Joe Camel.
Yeah, because it was cartoon advertising for kids. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting point. Thank you, Stuart. Lisa, you want to disagree. You're from Chicago, though. What would you think about this happening in Chicago? Lisa, you got to listen to your TV, not watch your TV, not watch your phone. Okay, Dick in Chicago, in Monica, Illinois, on listening to WCPT. Hey, Dick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to, we have a charity, federal charity called Schools Count, and we take supplies into the kids and teachers in 30 Chicago public schools, so I get a chance to see what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things going on that's not reported is that there are turnaround schools in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the public school is turned over to another agency. Everyone's fired. Well, the CPS system puts millions of dollars into these turnaround schools.
Right, CPS, Chicago Public Schools, right.
Correct. So the millions of dollars that are used to, quote, turn around the school that could otherwise be used for teachers, student supplies, and so forth, oftentimes just get put into these turnarounds so that they can become turnarounds.
Right. These were the pet projects, if my recollection is correct, of Arne Duncan when he was
Arne Duncan and Mayor Daley and Rahm Emanuel.
Right. So none of whom have a background in education, by the way.
Correct. So it's just one more thing that creates a harbinger of bad feelings among staff.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Dick, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. And thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Are sugary drinks and banning 32-inch big gulps, is that the nanny state on steroids, or is that good public policy? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There's actually a lot going on today. There's a lot in the news. There is frankly, from, you know, what's going on. This is the one-year anniversary of the Occupy movement, which is desperately needed. You know, the one thing this is one of the small debates that's happened over the last year within the Occupy movement is the, you know, what shall we do? How are we going to behave kind of thing? And there's that black block. Oh, let's go out there and trash things, you know, kick in windows and that corner, that kind of thing. That not only doesn't work, that's counterproductive. And then there's a very, very large group, you know, a large part of the Occupy movement that is absolutely committed to passive nonviolence. Look at what happened when those students at UC Davis sat in a row there and that cop walked up and down with a pepper spray. I mean, that guy lost his job. The whole world was horrified. It led the United Nations to say that, you know, we were mistreating our nonviolent protesters. There is incredible power in nonviolence. And I am so hopeful that as we move into the second year of the Occupy movement, that the Occupy movement will embrace more and more nonviolent tactics that highlight the, you know, basically, for lack of a better word, you know, the crimes and wrongs in our society, particularly those committed by the banksters and by the 1%. Who have been stealing us blind. I mean, literally stealing us blind. You get this rant in the first, when we first kicked off the show. Let me just, you know, repeat this. If we had not had the Reagan tax cuts and all the other changes in our tax laws since then, which have benefited the top 1% and the big corporations, if that had not happened, if wages had maintained pace with productivity, as they did from the administration of George Washington to the administration of Ronald Reagan, median household income in the United States right now would be twice what it is. It would be $100,000. Pretty much most all middle-class families would be able to afford a four-bedroom house. We could all be paying, except for the top 1%, a 5% tax rate because our corporations, which used to pay 30% of the load of government, are only paying 7% now. If we went back to the corporations paying the share that they used to pay, everybody could have health care for free and everybody could go to college for free. It used to be that way. You know, I tell young people this. I say, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, people could go to college for free. In states all over the United States, in these land-grant colleges that were created by Abraham Lincoln in 1862, University of California, tuition at many of the land-grant colleges was so low that it was virtually irrelevant. I mean, it was truly an incredible thing. It's truly an incredible thing. So we've got that. We've got the Chicago teacher strike ongoing. Colorado, maybe they're going to decriminalize pot. We'll see. That would be fascinating. France says no to GMO foods. Kofi Annan says the United States is one of the democracies in the world most at risk. Why? Because of our Supreme Court. Because of Citizens United. And then Mayor Bloomberg says, you know, we're spending millions of dollars on obesity that is caused by people drinking these large drinks and not realizing how many calories they're adding to their diet, not realizing that it's affecting them, their metabolism. Jerry in Minneapolis. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm definitely not for this because I think it's a pretty superficial thing because, I mean, what happens if I go to a restaurant where there's where I can just go up to a machine and get, you know, as much as I want. I mean, what does that do? 16 ounces will give you more exercise going from the table to the machine.
No, what they found, actually, there's something really interesting. And by the way, thanks for listening to KTNF. One of the things that they found is that people tend to eat or drink what's in front of them. And so if you get a 16-ounce glass and you fill it up and you bring it back to the table and you have your, you know, whatever your portions are that are in front of you, that's probably what you're going to drink. Whereas if you got a 32-ounce, that's probably what you're going to drink.
And I also have a question for you.
Okay.
How far would you go with this? Because I was wondering, like, if you say you had a radio show and it was broadcast in New York City, and say you were advertising.
I do, and it is.
Stream.
And if I was advertising what? I'm sorry.
Say it was advertising SodaStream, and he said,
"Which we do."
That would you accept that?
And what? There was a.
Would you accept that if you said, "I don't want to have radio shows on that advertise SodaStream"?
Yeah. You know, I pretty much have a policy with regard to my advertisers that there are some advertisers that we just won't take. You know, I mean, like if a tobacco company wanted to advertise with me, or if a slaughterhouse wanted to advertise with me, or even a company that sold, you know, whatever, things that I just, you know, I have a moral problem with. But beyond that, I don't tell them how to run their businesses. But yeah, SodaStream, they're not advertising with us right now, but they have advertised with us before. And in fact, Louise has been living on SodaStream. You know, it's make your own pop, basically. And they've the way that she does it is you carbonate the water, and then she adds like sour cherry extract, organic, you know, that you can buy from the health food store, or cranberry extract. You can make your own juices and things, you know, carbonated juices. So it's kind of cool stuff. So, no, I would not say no. The point is that when you go into a restaurant or when you go someplace, you tend to eat what's in front of you. I mean, there's a whole diet out there that actually works, which is where you simply eat half of whatever's put in front of you. You make that decision. You just say, that's it. You know, this particularly works for people who eat out a lot. And there are a lot of people who eat in restaurants a lot because of their work schedule or whatever. And you simply say, whatever is served to me, I am going to eat 50% of what's on every plate, every serving, everything. And if you do that religiously over a period of 6 months or a year, you will lose weight. It's like magic. So, you know, Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, Sirius XM. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to let you know that when my mother and I were in Japan in 2008, that's before the tsunami and the earthquakes and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it was only the second time I had went there. She was born and raised there, and I said to her, Ma, there's no heavy people here.
Right.
She says, honey, she says, there's no junk food here. And I said, what do you mean? She says, you're not going to find Kentucky Fried Chickens or McDonald's or any of that. And, you know, I'm like, well, you know, and I was like jonesing for a hamburger. And I'm like, well, where am I going to get that? You know, and she's like, no, honey, you're going to eat fish and rice and, you know, and all the tofu. And I loved it. I mean, I didn't gain 1 pound when I was there, Tom.
Well, and here's
here's
the big difference. And I've spent a lot of time in Japan, Linda. I used to do business in Japan. And Louise and I, we have a very dear friend who he and his wife and their kids, they're good friends of ours. We've been in their home. We've stayed in their home in Tokyo. The food portions, when you eat in a restaurant in Japan, the amount of food that's put on your plate is not like in the United States. And the same in Europe. I mean, we lived in Europe for a year. We go back every year. I'm in Germany literally every year, have been for 30 plus years. And when you go into a restaurant, I don't care what you order, the portion size that you get is half of what it is in the United States. For some reason, we've gone into this obese-based portion size. And like I said, people eat what's put in front of them. There is,
but it's
junk,
healthier in their time.
Well,
it's so
there
healthy,
is there is there is junk food in Japan. I mean, you can. In fact, the last time I was there, but a couple of years ago I was there, and our friend Ken that I mentioned, we were staying at his house. He and his wife took us to a Pizza Hut, and because they thought, hey, we're Americans, we'd want to eat American food, right? And so we went to this Pizza Hut, and you know what was really interesting is there was no cheese on the pizza. You had to go and like make
cheese.
A special request for the cheese. The default was no cheese. And you know, when they brought it to the table, I was like, there's no cheese on this pizza. And he was like, yeah, of course not. And I was like, why? And he said, well, in Japan, we think of cheese as the rotted excretion of a cow's breast. And who would want to drink that? You know, the mammary fluid from a cow that's been rotted. And
I never grew up with cheese.
Yeah, I mean, they're just like they do not, you know, they do not use dairy products in Japan, and they do not use dairy products either in Thailand. They just absolutely it's almost impossible to find dairy products in Thailand. And did you know that Thailand has the lowest rate of breast cancer in the world?
Yeah,
I mean, it's astounding.
It's all related to things, right? Everything relates to everything.
Yeah, I think that, you know, all these hormones that they give cows, and then we drink their milk, and we eat their cheese, and we eat their flesh and whatnot. You know, it's just my own personal conspiracy theory. Who knows?
There's one movie that you have to remember. Okay, and your thing relate. I'll make it real quick. Your thing relating to advertising to kids.
Mm-hmm.
Go back to the movie Back to the Future.
Uh-huh.
Michael J. Fox.
The first one.
He goes back to the future, and he's in that restaurant, and he says, "Give me a Pepsi free." And the guy's looking at him like, "Well, you want a Pepsi or pay for it?" And he goes, "No, okay, give me a cab." You know, he was looking for something with sugar. He goes, "You want a cab? You're gonna pay for it."
Right. I got it. Linda, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. We will be back with more right after this. Stick around. Tom Hartman.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news?
Well, let's check out our news. This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at donsiegelman.org. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I don't have anything for you on the teacher strike. I have heard nothing about movement on that front.
Okay, so in other words, they're still out on strike and the city has not been able to force them back, and it's just rhetoric on both sides so far.
Yes, rhetoric.
No big changes. Okay.
No big changes, no. What I do have for you from Mother Jones is that they have got hold of a video from a private Romney fundraiser earlier this year.
Okay.
Which the Romney campaign is not saying is fake, and I've seen all the clips that have been made available so far, and it's clearly Romney is clearly legitimate. When he talks about what he really thinks of things, and he talks about what he thinks of voters who support Barack Obama.
And he said what?
He said, it's a six-line quotation. There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government who has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it, that that's an entitlement, and the government should give it to them, and they will vote for this president no matter what. These are people who pay no income tax. My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives.
Wow. This is the whole he's the food stamp president guy thing.
Right. This was after he clinched the nomination.
And he's claiming that that's 47% of the electorate?
47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what.
And the people voting for the president are roughly half of the electorate. So he's saying that's about a quarter of all voters?
That's what he's saying.
That's remarkable.
Yes.
I mean, I will concede that there is a small underclass in the United States and in every other country that has welfare benefits of people who are probably at some level, you know, damaged or mentally ill. The percentage is typically somewhere between 2-4% who very much want to live on the dole. And they will go to whatever extent necessary to live on the dole. And frankly, I don't have a problem supporting that 2-4% if that means that the other 96% of us have a social safety net so that if we try to become entrepreneurs and we trip and we fall, we've got something to fall into. Or if, you know, God forbid, a loved one should die or our family falls apart or our house gets blown away by a tornado, there is something that will catch us. I think it's a reasonable price to be paid. But to claim that 2-3-4% of people who are the, you know, professional live on the dole folks is actually 25% of the electorate, that's mind-boggling.
It's fascinating. He also talks in some detail about how to target and how to frame his what he's saying, in other words, how to spin his message to undecided voters and how not to say it and how it needs to be said but privately. In other words, if you pay a very high dollar amount to see Mitt Romney, you can hear these things, but he doesn't say them publicly. More video is going to be made available.
Wow. Any little juicy ones you want to share with us?
Yeah, very, very interesting. He says about his family background, about his father, had he been born of Mexican parents, I'd have a better shot of winning this.
Was that a shot at the birther, at, you know, at Obama not being a citizen's kind of thing?
I don't know what that's a shot at. I think it's a way of saying that you've got a better shot if you're a minority.
Yeah, he's saying he would have gotten the Hispanic vote.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, his grandfather was born in Mexico.
Yes.
Well, actually, no, his father was born in Mexico.
Father was born in Mexico, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
but
you know.
He's not of Hispanic descent.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Interesting. Okay, so what else is going on in the world that's real news?
Well, real news, besides that, because that is going to be big, the Obama administration filed a World Trade Organization case against China today. President Obama made the announcement in Ohio and came under a lot of questions from the press for that. Basically, what it is about accusing China of unfairly subsidizing its exports of cars and car parts. It accuses China of providing at least $1 billion worth of subsidies from 2009 to 2011 for exports of autos and auto parts.
Right. Now, I read in the Financial Times article on this that another part of that was that the Chinese apparently have an import duty, a tariff, on U.S. cars being sold in China, and he's also protesting that.
Yes, he is also protesting that. He has two protests. Also, this this case today has been in the works since last winter, and the Obama administration maintains that the fact that it's being announced today in Ohio, where which is the hub of the auto parts industry, just happens to fit in with the timing that the case actually became ready to be filed.
Well, I mean, you know, I want to see Barack Obama elected, but if you want me to believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. I, you know, I can see where, you know, plus or minus a week or so of now, but just today.
I know. Also,
yeah.
Citizens United has struck a deal with a dozen television stations to run its hour-long film featuring voters disaffected with President Barack Obama, sending the Republican critique of him into tens of millions of homes in the lead-up to Election Day. The Hope and the Change is the film, made by the same guy who made the Sarah Palin movie, The Undefeated. And this is the why I did Citizens United, says David Bossie, the group's president. This would have been a criminal act under McCain-Feingold before my court case.
Yeah. The question is anybody other than Fox News watchers going to watch it?
Well, I think that's the question. I mean, it's going to air on a number of different networks, but whether anybody will sit through an hour of disillusioned real voters and a sad commentary, I think is questionable.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. Sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at donsiegelman.org. Check it out. 58 minutes before the hour, we will be back with more on Occupy Wall Street and how the game is rigged.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, wow, Chicago teacher strike still ongoing. Mitt Romney says a quarter at, Shano actually has the text of his comments. Can you make your mic hot there, Shane? Tell us what did Romney actually say to his high? These were the people who gave him, what, 10, 20, 30,000 bucks, the large $100,000, the large donors. Somebody videotaped this without his knowledge, apparently. And he said,
there are 47% of people who will vote for the president no matter what. And then he goes on, all right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, who believe that they are victims, who believe the government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe that they are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it.
So, but the important part here is that very first, repeat the first 10 words or
sure.
so.
There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what.
Okay, so what he's saying is the 47% of the electorate are basically on welfare.
Because he goes on and says, all right, there are 47% who are with him, who are dependent upon government, et cetera.
Right, right. Amazing.
So he's not saying 47% of 47%.
You know, yeah, no. So that's incredible. I find that absolutely amazing. You know, as I pointed out, as I commented to Victoria Jones, there you're always going to have some free riders in a system. I mean, no matter what, there are going to be some people who fake injuries in order to get Social Security assistance or in order to get insurance. There are going to be people who you know, there's always a small percentage of people who are, you know, basically fraudsters, who aren't playing the game the right way, who aren't playing an honest game. But that doesn't mean you shut down the system. You know, the fact that banks get robbed doesn't mean you stop having banks. The fact that Bernie Madoff can make off with a fortune doesn't mean that you stop having investment houses. Or the fact that the banking system nearly brought the entire world to its knees, did bring the entire world to its knees, nearly brought it face down, doesn't mean you shut it down. Although, frankly, it should mean that you reform it dramatically. But Romney just coming in. Now, maybe he's talking about people on Social Security. Maybe he's including them in there and people on Medicare and Medicaid. But those are all programs that we pay into, or at least Medicare. We pay into Social Security throughout our lives. That's my money coming back to me if I retire. If I'm old enough to, you know, I'm not old enough to get it now, but, you know, should the day come. And Medicare, you know, that's money that I've been paying in since I was a kid. How is that being dependent upon the government? Any more than having a health insurance policy and then they pay your bills when you go to the hospital means that you're dependent on your health insurance company. I suppose arguably you're relying on them. But, you know, hey, I paid into this. I find it all rather mind-boggling. Anyhow, it's the first anniversary of the Occupy movement, 1 year from today. Mark Taylor Canfield with Occupy Seattle, blogging on the Occupy movement over at Huffington Post and various other places. Mark, what's going on with the Occupy movement right now?
Well, Tom, it's really good to talk with you again, and I want to thank you so much for giving the Occupy movement its creds, because I have a real issue with CNN and some other news outlets claiming that the movement has, quote, fizzled.
Well, we're going to have Jay Meyerson on after the next break at 20 minutes after also to riff on this from the New York side, but you're on the West Coast side, so you're from your point of view.
Well, let CNN tell that to 104 people who were arrested today while trying to hold the banksters accountable on Wall Street. That number was verified earlier by the OWS legal team in New York City. But here in Seattle, there's a federal grand jury that's convened to investigate activists in the Northwest. In Portland, the FBI conducted violent raids on the homes of activists. And in Seattle, the Seattle Police Department SWAT team did the same kind of thing on an apartment where Occupy activists live. And in both cities, the police and FBI used flash grenades on these raids, didn't arrest anyone, but confiscated political material, clothing, and electronic equipment. And because of these grand juries, there have been constant protests and vigils at the federal courthouse here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But today, folks are going to be showing their solidarity with their friends in New York City by holding a march against Wall Street and then a silent vigil at Westlake Park, where they'll be taping dollar bills over their mouths with messages saying money is not free speech. And I'll be out there handing out copies of my Declaration of Independence to folks and trying to let everybody in Seattle know that the Occupy movement is strong. It hasn't gone away. We've been having our general assemblies. There's a lot of working groups doing money drops here and Occupy film series and free food distribution programs and a free library. So I will quote Mark Twain again, or at least paraphrase him once again, and say that any rumors about the death of the Occupy movement have been greatly exaggerated, Tom. And today,
amen,
I think we're going to prove it around the country.
Amen. And in fact, the Occupy movement has also been working in some places, in Las Vegas in particular, in helping people keep their homes. You know, and Detroit, occupy the houses, occupy the mortgage, or whatever it's called.
Yes. Here it's called SAFE, and we've been doing the same thing. And I want to direct people to the S17NYC website. That's S17 dot, or excuse me, S 17 for September 17th, nyc.org. And that will give you a quick update on everything that's going on in New York City today. We're watching on the live stream now. People are still marching. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they're still having a great time. They had a talk from Reverend Billy a little while ago. And
oh, great. The Church of Stop Shopping.
So, yes, he was awesome. And people are really in high spirits, even though they've lost over 100 of their number today due to random arrests by the New York Police Department. So yeah. Part of what folks are doing in New York City is they're getting ready for jail solidarity, which means that they're going to be at the jails waiting for their friends to get out, holding rallies there.
Yeah.
So we in Seattle just want to say solidarity to them and to everyone else around the country. And thanks once again, Tom, for, you know, helping us occupy the media, because we really rely on independent voices like yours out there to let people know that we're doing this. Otherwise, it's pretty tough, you know, to get through the corporate media. So I appreciate that very much.
I'm with you, Mark. Mark, thank you very much for your kind words. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the update. And, let us not forget that in New York City, Jamie Dimon, Citibank, gave over $4 million to the New York Police Benevolent Association, or whatever it's called, the police, kind of slush fund for families and whatnot, which is a good fund and has good purposes. But the cops know that the banks gave them $4 million and the Occupy protesters didn't. And then you got Mayor Bloomberg, who has referred to the police department as his private army. So, you know, ain't such a good thing. Ain't such a good thing. Elizabeth, listening to us on KABQ in Albuquerque. Hey, Elizabeth, what's up?
Hey, Tom. My name's Elizabeth. I'm calling, it's like that network movie. You know, I'm mad as blank. I'm not going to take it anymore. Well, I guess I'm calling you not only to vent, but maybe for some advice. You're the smartest guy I know. About a year ago, about 9 months ago, I entered into a home loan modification, or I tried to get one out of the Bank of America,
mm-hmm.
at which point they said, sure, you fit the parameters perfectly. You just fill out these forms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that began the nightmare. More forms, more this, more that. You didn't send in the right this, the right that.
Mm.
So now these buggers want to come and foreclose on my house.
Mm.
So, I mean, you know, we talk about all these.
You need a lawyer, Elizabeth.
Pardon me?
You need a lawyer.
Oh, yeah, I got one of them.
Okay. Because, do you know if the chain of custody on the mortgage is intact?
What do you mean by that?
Well, what's happened is that a lot of these banks, when they initially sold the mortgages, they sold them to be divided up into little pieces, tranched, and they no longer have the documents. And that's why they hired these people to robo-sign things. And increasingly, you go to court and you say, I'd like to see the chain of custody on this mortgage. And even before you get to court, just ask for it. And, you know, make sure that your lawyer is pursuing that, because there are judges around the country who are simply throwing out foreclosure efforts based on that. But if you don't have a lawyer who's doing what you want, shop around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is, you know, we have seen criminality on an epic proportion in the United States, and very few people are standing up. We all need to.
Welcome to the occupation. Here we stand and here we fight. All your fallen heroes, held and died and skinned alive.
1 year from today, the Occupy movement was birthed in Zuccotti Park in New York City, and here we are 1 year later. J.A. Meyerson on the line with us. He's an Occupy Wall Street participant, a freelance journalist, and contributor to truthout.org, jameyerson.com, also the website, as well as truthout.org. J.A., welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us from what you're seeing and what you're reporting. Are you, first of all, are you in New York City today?
I sure am. I've been there all day, and I have to tell you, I'm a little bit broken up right now because I just watched my very, very close friend, John Neffel, who I believe has been on your program, snatched off the sidewalk doing nothing objectionable, thrown down in the middle of the street with a knee in his back, handcuffed and thrown in a paddy wagon for zero offense while he was a journalist on the job. And I probably don't need to tell you this, it's Constitution Day today. So how's that for your First Amendment?
Wow. Today's the federal holiday of Constitution Day. I didn't know that.
Well, so says Twitter. I can't confirm it.
Yeah. Okay. So, but this is certainly, I mean, you know, the First Amendment guarantees our right to peaceably assemble and petition our government for redress of grievances if what you guys are doing doesn't fall into that category.
And it ensures that the police will not get in the way of the Fourth Estate, who are the only safeguard that we have against tyranny.
According to Thomas Jefferson, no less, you know, the founder, the author of the Declaration of Independence. So what was your friend doing that caused the police to throw him on the ground, stick a knee in his back, put handcuffs on him, and throw him in a paddy wagon?
Simply standing on the sidewalk, observing the march that was happening and doing his job as a journalist. That's been the police's tactic all day. It's actually been quite an exuberant and beautiful day. There have been tons of people. Zuccotti Park was full again and thriving. There was music, and everyone was jubilant and hugging friends that they hadn't seen in forever. And there were excellent actions, marches on Chase and on Wells Fargo and on Citibank and on Goldman Sachs. And it's been really quite a wonderful day, except for the fact that every time we have a march, the police, rather than maintaining order and safety in the city of New York as their charge is, have sent goons onto the sidewalk simply to yank people out into the middle of the street who were doing nothing wrong, who were not in the street, and throw them down and arrest them, often quite brutally. And when it is apparently random, I suspect that that is to send a chilling effect into the rest of the march and squash dissent, and otherwise it sometimes seems as though it's targeted. In any case, this is the second time they've done it to John Neffel, and he's already a named plaintiff in a suit against them, and the suit is called Rodriguez versus Winsky, for anybody who wants to look that up at home.
Wow. So, J.A., do you think that this has anything to do with the fact that that Jamie Dimon and his bank gave over $4 million to the police association, the private association associated with the, you know, the charitable association associated with the New York City Police Department, and Occupy Wall Street, to the best of my knowledge, has given them nothing?
Yeah, I'm sure it doesn't hurt that Occupy Wall Street is not funding the police and the banks are. But, I mean, that's essentially the state of the political economy all over the United States, where essentially the functions of government are captured by the interests of capital and do the bidding of the interests of capital more than the interests of the people. And especially when the main antagonists against the people, the reason that everyone is suffering, everyone is debt-strapped and having a difficult time finding work, and a lot of people are starving, and a lot of people are in prison. The reason all of this is happening is because there are profiteers at the very top scooping up all of the money that these private prisons make and that pollution helps to create and that the exploitation of workers and union busting creates. And this essential power dynamic where wealth is immune to justice and controls all of the functions of the state and benefits from everybody's misery and struggle, that the only people who are trying to fix the situation are folks like Occupy Wall Street and the unions and everybody who's making noise in the street. And that is every reason for the ruling classes to stick their police departments on us and arrest us violently.
Yeah. Where do you see the Occupy movement going from here, J.A.?
Well, I think that the Occupy movement has had a sort of 1 year of germination, and I think we're still essentially in an incubation period. Francis Fox Piven wrote a wonderful piece recently about how you can't expect any large wins from a movement that's been organizing for less than a decade, and I think that's borne out with a look through history. I think that what's happening right now that's quite exciting, and I wrote about this in my most recent piece that just came out today in TruthOut, if folks want to look it up, is that different activists are adopting different projects and different campaigns and starting different organizations and trying to organize students or trying to organize the unemployed or trying to organize youth in minority communities that are beset by terrible police violence and police brutality. So people are going out and doing these different projects. And part of what today acts as is a catalyst for everyone to come together and organize with each other and try and foster solidarity with one another. So I think that the value of celebrating anniversaries like we've done today is first remaining strong in the streets and keeping morale up. And secondly, allowing the different people who are tackling these different challenges of neoliberal corporate capitalism and allowing them to organize together. So really what I think the key thing to look at going forward is to keep an eye on the different projects and organizations and affiliations and networks that are going to emerge from this. Because whatever the meaningful social movement is over the next 10 to 20 years, all of the leaders and participants will have participated in an occupation somewhere across our great country. So I think that's really where to focus from now on is not so much on anything officially calling itself Occupy Wall Street, but all of the different excellent projects that occupiers are adopting.
So the Occupy movement is still a horizontal movement. There are no leaders.
Well, I would phrase it differently. I would say that we're all leaders, right? The goal isn't to produce leaderlessness. It's to produce leaderfulness, where there's a universal leadership and everybody feels empowered to step up and to use their skills the best way they know how. Sometimes that leadership takes the form of feeding people in the park, and sometimes it takes the form of facilitating meetings.
Got it.
But I think that's...
Jay, we're out of time, but I got it. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can read J.A.'s piece at truthout.org, jamyerson.com. J.A., thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very inexpugnably ugly. The good. The people of the world. On Friday, UN officials told a conference in Geneva, Switzerland, that the ozone hole over the Antarctic will be smaller this year than it was last year. The officials also said that this goes to show how a ban on harmful substances like CFCs has helped to stop ozone depletion. The ban on chemicals like CFCs was initiated with the signing of the Montreal Protocol 25 years ago. UN weather expert Geir Braathen told reporters at the Geneva conferences that the ban, quote, has prevented a major environmental disaster and globally ozone depletion has leveled off. So what's the bottom line here? Despite what Republicans in Washington will tell you, climate change is very real and it can also be curbed directly through human action. We have a lot of work to do to save our environment and it's time we got started. The bad. Congressman Peter King. On NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, King told David Gregory that President Obama's orders to withdraw troops from Iraq and end the war there brought on last week's embassy attacks in the Middle East. King's promotion of the right's apology tour aside, President Obama withdrew troops from Iraq because he recognized it was time to end the most unnecessary war in American history. And let's not forget, Iraqi officials, our allies, wanted U.S. troops to leave. Leaving Iraq is not what caused last week's violence in the Middle East. And the very, very ugly Newsweek. Moving on from Congressman King's outrageous comments to an outrageous magazine cover, this week's edition of Newsweek released today features a picture of Muslims with a big, bold title of Muslim Rage. After the attacks in Benghazi last week, we saw numerous images of Libyans holding up signs in support of the U.S., and in support of what Ambassador Chris Stevens was doing in their country. And that wasn't a fluke. Despite what conservatives preach, the majority of Muslims are peaceful people who do not encourage violence against Americans and do not preach hatred of American ideals. Islamic radicals killed Ambassador Stevens, not all Muslims. Just like Islamic radicals perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, and not all Muslims. As a nation, we need to understand that the sins of a few should not automatically be placed on the many. But apparently Newsweek is willing to cast that inaccurate and ignorant blanket statement, and that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Welcome back, Richard in Los Angeles. Hey, Richard, what's up on your what's up?
What's hey, how mind? You doing today, Tom?
Good.
I was calling because I heard the lady earlier that was complaining about her bank going to foreclose on her house.
Yeah.
My sister-in-law went through a situation here recently with her bank where they were going to foreclose on her, and then they offered her an option for a short sale at, you know, under which the terms supposedly her house would sell for less than what she owed, and the bank would forgive the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But what it turned out was there was a real estate agent that was in her area that had been in that had an inside person at the bank that would let them, that agent, know about houses in that area that the bank held the paper on that were going to, you know, that were getting behind. The real estate agent then approached my sister-in-law and was like, you know, it's public record that your house is behind right now. Let me help you sell it, you know, and we'll get this short sale done and you're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out to be a huge scam. The real estate agent supposedly had a buyer who was HUD qualified that was going to come in and buy the house.
Right.
They were pushing my sister-in-law to hurry up and move because they were like, well, even though you're going to short sale, you know, because you stayed in the house up until the point of the time of the sale and it wasn't vacant, the bank was supposed to pay her a certain amount for, like, keeping the house up till she moved.
Mm-hmm.
Had the house sold legitimately, she would have gotten that, and it would have been a good short sale.
Mm-hmm.
The real estate agent, though, with help from somebody she had on the inside, had actually set up to buy the house herself for less than what they were telling my sister-in-law the short sale was going to go through for. She was going to take and flip it to somebody completely different that was not the HUD buyer, and they were going to do modifications to the house that would have voided the terms of the short sale with the bank.
Right.
Which would have led my sister-in-law to be out of the house, still owe what the difference was between what the bank sold it to the real estate agent for and what she owed, which would have left her with almost $180,000 worth of debt.
What?
No home. And the real estate agent was going to flip the house for the commission on the original sale and commission on the second sale plus the increase in the sale price, which would have netted the real estate agent close to $100,000.
Wow. It's like the vultures are circling.
Well, the only way she found out was that somebody in the process of sending out paperwork all over the place accidentally left two sets of documents in one envelope that got sent to her. Some of it was paperwork that she was supposed to sign, but as she started reading through it, she found a whole nother set of documents that were not intended for her eyes that basically were documents that were going to the new buyer.
Wow. Wow. Incredible.
As the owner of the home.
Yeah.
And what it was the real estate agent was pushing my sister-in-law to, like, we're going to do the walkthrough, do the HUD inspection, and then you need to move immediately, get out of the house, so that HUD could come back in and reinspect it with nobody in the home. But the plan was they had a home fix-it guy that was going to come in and start doing work on the house to, quote-unquote, make it uninhabitable, which would have voided her sale terms with her lender.
Wow.
She wound up, thank God, she had prepaid legal, and she got a hold of a real estate attorney, and I forget the name of the company he works for, but he's out of L.A., out of downtown Los Angeles, and he works for a company that's one of the biggest real estate legal firms in the country.
Yeah.
And basically, he started looking at this stuff, and he told her, do not move.
Yeah. Tragically, this has become a major industry in the United States. You know, lawyers helping out people who have been screwed by a series of what I would call crimes by these banks. And in fact, what federal courts have called crimes. And it is just a mind-boggling that they get away with it. Richard, thanks for sharing the story with us. Fred in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Fred, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
How you doing?
Good.
I was pulling reference to you saying about corporate America taking over the government.
How is that possible? And what are you referring to? Like corporations of, like I'm incorporated. I have a business and I'm incorporated. I have right. about 250 employees. I don't seem to be trying to take over the government. So
you have 250 employees?
Yes.
So what's your annual revenue?
My gross annual revenue is about $17 million.
Okay. So in most congressional districts in the United States, for about 10% of your gross revenue, you could buy a congressional seat right now. Do you think that that's right?
Well, first of all, I didn't even know about that. Second of all...
Well, typically a congressional seat, so, you know, the amount of money spent by each candidate in the average congressional seat in the United States is a little under $500,000. So
right.
if you want to drop $500,000 into a congressional race, you could flip that race. You could make sure that somebody either wins or loses. Do you think that okay. one businessman who has one business interest who, you know, should either A, be able to put the fear of God in an elected official, or B, be able to promote into a place of being an elected official somebody who is beholden to you? Do you think that's right?
Well, to be honest with you, I never thought about it because I never knew that that's possible. Secondly,
well, it's happening every day here in Washington, D.C., literally every day.
Well, what kind of companies, of what type of gross revenue you talk about?
Well, usually it's companies much, much larger than yours. It's companies
right.
that wouldn't have to spend
right.
10% of their revenue. It's companies that would have to spend 0.001% of their revenue. It's, you know,
right.
it's well, just, hey. This is the most recent
right.
one. Listen to this. You know the story of Shelley Adelson, the billionaire casino guy who gave millions of dollars to Newt Gingrich to keep him going. Well, he's got
yeah.
a competitor, a guy by the name of Joe Ricketts. He founded TD Ameritrade.
Mm-hmm.
He has created his own PAC, and he's put $10 million so far into supporting Mitt Romney, another $2 million into Republicans, into buying congressional seats. And he just started his own super PAC called Ending Spending Action Fund. He's hired staff. He's personally overseeing it. He is going to decide one guy, one billionaire. And for him, you know, $100 million is nothing, right? It's chump change. It's the equivalent, you know, probably for you of $5,000. And he is going to use that money to buy congressional seats. I personally don't think that's the definition of a republic. I think that's the definition of an oligarchy. But, you know, Fred, if you think that's okay, so
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your thoughts and mine. The news of the day right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Indeed. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Paul in Greenville, South Carolina, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Paul, what's up?
I have a question for you. I hear you talking about Citizens United and all this super PAC money. What's any difference than Bill Maher giving $1 million to Obama and Oprah Winfrey giving $10 million to Obama and all these Hollywood people giving millions of dollars? He had a fundraiser in Hollywood, and he got like $8 million from that fundraiser.
Right.
Why is that any different than these super PACs? It's the same exact thing.
Why is it any different than Shelley Adelson, for example, giving $100 million to defeat Obama, for example?
So what?
Okay.
So
well,
what?
Here,
let me just
ask you a question. And I mean this seriously, Paul. Shelley Adelson knows... In fact, he said it at a meeting. It was recorded. He said it at a meeting that the Koch brothers held, that if he makes that $100 million investment, he's going to make back, if Mitt Romney is elected and if Mitt Romney drops the capital gains tax to zero and does away with the inheritance tax and reduces the top income tax rate from 36% to 25%, all things Romney's promised to do. Shelley Adelson knows that that $100 million investment will produce for him a $2 billion return. Okay, so it's a return on investment. And Adelson was right up front about it. He said, when I am putting money into these politicians, I'm making an investment. Now, please tell me what Bill Maher is going to get for the $1 million that he gave Obama.
You have to ask Bill Maher that. He's getting kicked back somewhere. I mean, people just don't give $1 million
away without making money somewhere.
Well, maybe in your world. In my world, Paul, people...
I was born a Democrat. My whole family was Democratic. Everybody in my family was a Democrat. I'm the last one to switch, and I have just recently switched to a Republican.
Paul, let me just finish this sentence. Whatever your
every time there's been a Democrat in office, I have lost.
Paul, what
my
is
income has gone down?
Well, the fact of the matter is, actually, if you look ever since Dwight Eisenhower's presidency, ever since the end of World War II, that when Democrats are in office, the stock market goes up more than it does when Republicans are in office, and employment, the total number of people employed and the total number of dollars that they're making, goes up more than when Republicans are in office. And that is an absolute fact. I defy you to prove otherwise. It is an absolute statement of fact. But again, the question, we know that the billionaires and the big corporations who are putting hundreds of millions to billions of dollars into the Romney campaign, the Ryan campaign, and Republican campaigns against the country, around the country, that what they're going to get back is a reduction. They're going to literally get back more money than they put in.
And Oprah Winfrey
Bill Maher and Oprah. Let me finish a sentence here. Bill Maher, Oprah Winfrey, Barbara Streisand, me. You know, I don't put in $1 million, but I put in $100. Those of us who contribute to progressive causes, what we expect to get back is a world where I'm just going to put you on hold here for a minute, Paul, so I can finish a sentence. What I expect to get back from my $100 donation, and what I'm guessing Bill Maher is going to get back from his $1 million donation, is a world where if he's standing at a bus stop, the guy next to him who's coughing doesn't have tuberculosis, because we all have health care. Where if his child or his niece or nephew or one of my kids or God willing, someday I should have grandchildren, decides that they want to start a business and they slip and fall and they have to declare bankruptcy, that it's not the end of their lives. They can do like Henry Ford did and declare bankruptcy 7 times if necessary. That if tragedy befalls them, if like my friend Michael Hutchison, who was out running in Santa Fe a decade ago and tripped and fell and broke his neck in his late 30s and ended up paralyzed from the neck down, if that happens to them or anybody I know or anybody in my society, that there will be Social Security there that isn't run by Wall Street, that will pay for them and that will cover them. In other words, that we live in a society that is a decent, healthy, happy society. Paul, that's what I believe Bill Maher and Oprah Winfrey, and what I can tell you I am investing in when I invest in Democrats, not that my taxes are going to get dropped.
Who's going to pay for it?
We are paying for it right now. Social Security is paying for my friend Michael Hutchison. One-third of all Social Security payments go to people who are injured and disabled.
Who's going to pay for Obamacare? Who's going to pay for that?
Obamacare actually reduces the amount of money that we're all spending on health care, Paul.
How do you figure? We've gone $5 trillion more in debt in 3.5 years.
That has nothing to do with Obamacare.
How do you buy your way out of debt? It's impossible.
You ever heard of Dwight Eisenhower?
He's an idiot. I personally thought Dwight Eisenhower, I don't like the man.
Paul, Dwight Eisenhower was an idiot. When Dwight Eisenhower came into office, it was after World War II, our debt-to-GDP ratio was 127 to 1. We were at 127% of GDP, our debt was.
That's before my time.
Right. It was before my time, too. Actually, when Dwight Eisenhower came into office, I was 1 year old.
That
it was 1952.
It doesn't concern me.
Okay.
I wasn't born.
It was real, though. And do you know how Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican president, two-term Republican president, Richard Nixon was his vice president, you know how he got that debt paid from 127% of debt, which is right now we're not even 100%. We're just close to it. How he got that from 127% of debt down to, what, 20% of debt, 15% of debt? You know how he did that?
Started a welfare system?
No. He built highways. He built roads. He built schools. The federal government spent 70% of the cost of every school built in the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The federal government spent 65% of the cost of every hospital built in the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Dwight Eisenhower initiated that process. That created so much growth. All that great education, you know, great healthcare system, an interstate highway system so that commerce could happen, created so much growth that so many people started making so much money that they paid so much taxes that it paid off our national debt. That's how it happened, and that's what we need to be doing right now. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest in the Chicago teachers' strike, plus tax cuts for the rich and why they don't stimulate the economy. Of a rumble with conservative Peter Ferrara, our Taking Your Country Back segment. Minnesota congressional candidate Jim Graves is going to be with us, running against Michelle Bachmann. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, occupy something. It's the one-year anniversary. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.